Legal Face-Off on WGNRadio.com is brought to you by McCorkle Litigation Services, leaders in court reporting and legal technology.
Hey, what's up, y'all? It's your man Montel Jordan, and this is how we do it. And right now, you're listening to Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. That's right, you're locked onto the high-energy legal podcast with lawyers Rich Lenkov and Tina Martini, and they're going to be trading jabs on the breaking news and the hottest issues, sports, entertainment, politics. Nothing is off limits. Keep listening, because this is how we do it.
Welcome to another edition of Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. Of course, we have Tina Martini of McDermott, Will & Emery, and Rich Lenkov from Downey & Lenkov. I'm your moderator, Ryan Burrow. Kamala Harris now appears to be at the top of the ticket for the Democrats this November, but there still may be some legal hurdles the Harris campaign faces. Nima Romani is the president and co-founder of West Coast Trial Lawyers. He's a former federal prosecutor. He's done some election law in L.A. You may have seen him on Inside Edition, CNN, BBC, Fox News, just to name a few. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Of course, Ryan. Thanks for having me, as always.
So as of like literally this morning, Republicans are still questioning Kamala's ability to step in for Biden. One argument that they're making is that FEC, Federal Election Commission rules, dictate that she cannot access Biden's campaign funds. Will that argument succeed?
I don't think so, for two reasons, both procedurally and substantively. Substantively, it was a joint campaign committee. Harris's name was on the committee. So presumably, it's like having a joint account. You know, anyone can access the funds. And procedurally, the FEC is so backed up on their enforcement actions, there's absolutely no way that anything is going to be done before the election. And even if it were, we're talking about a three Republican and three Democrat gridlock commission. And of course, there's going to be appeals that can take it out of the administrative process and in court. So it's a losing argument, both on the substance and the procedure.
About the argument that electors voted for Biden to be the candidate and not Harris, and that a few party insiders are now picking her, which is undemocratic.
Well, the undemocratic argument isn't necessarily a legal argument, and political parties have a lot of control over who they nominate. They can make the rules and they can change those rules. This actually came out in some of the 14th Amendment Section 3 litigation, trying to keep Trump off the ballot for being an insurrectionist. And there were some judges that said, well, even if he can't hold office, parties can nominate who they want. Now, obviously, we'd have to go through each state's election laws to see if that argument holds water, but I think that's going to be very tough. Biden was never the nominee. The DNC hasn't even happened yet. So those delegates, even if they're pledged delegates, can vote for whomever they want.
Another argument being made in particular this week by Speaker Mike Johnson is that the campaign, now with Harris as the head, will have trouble meeting deadlines imposed by several states, including some battleground states like Georgia, Nevada, Wisconsin. What do you make of that argument?
Yeah, so we saw this in Ohio, and they had to push their deadline back. The DNC is late this year, coincidentally, fortunately, however you want to say it. But that's a different argument. There are state deadlines to put someone on the ballot. And regardless of whether it's Biden, Harris, or someone else, those deadlines have to be met. So if Democrats can't meet those deadlines, Speaker Johnson may have an argument there.
But I think just to your point, and what a lot of people, I didn't know really, to be honest, before this week, is that like the Democratic Party is a private entity. And, you know, there's no constitutional rule about this. And, you know, they can change their rules, and the likelihood that they will not do that in the face of what everyone agrees is the candidate is almost nil, right? I mean, that doesn't mean that Republicans aren't going to sue because of it, right? But I mean, the chances of that litigation being successful is pretty minimal, right?
Oh, that's absolutely right. The bottom line is, like you said, this is a private entity. They can make whatever rules they want. They can change those rules. Might be unfair. Might be undemocratic, but that's not a legal basis to challenge who becomes the Democratic nominee. That's why this argument is a long shot, has very little chance of success. But we know Trump can be very litigious. That hasn't stopped him before.
Nima, will any of this be playing out at the convention? As you mentioned, the convention's pretty late this year. So do you think that this is still going to be kicked around in the next several weeks, or do you think these issues are going to be resolved by then?
I wouldn't be surprised if Trump, the RNC, or even the Heritage Foundation has come out and they've raised some questions about this switch. So I expect a lawsuit to be filed. I'm surprised it hasn't happened yet, frankly. Probably next week. They're probably trying to find some sort of precedent. And of course, this is very unprecedented for a challenge here. But I think this is something that ultimately will be unsuccessful. But I expect that challenge to be raised and for it to be an issue and to be unresolved by the time the DNC rolls around.
Last question here, Anima, we appreciate it, is that as we often say with these stories, you can't ever look at it, even though we're a legal show, you can't ever look at it only from a legal prism without considering politics. You know, Kamala certainly has some momentum now coming out of this announcement. Do you think there is the political will to support a challenge like this? Again, there's certainly many on the Republican side who are going to support such litigation, but overall, is your sense that there's the political will among the electorate and courts to take up this challenge or not? Or is it too early to say?
I do, and this is why. I mean, we saw it with the 14th Amendment litigation in almost every state. You know, Democrats challenged Trump's ability to be on the ballot. Most of those challenges failed for a number of reasons. Obviously, Trump wasn't charged with insurrection, much less convicted. And we talked about the political party issue. But there was at least one state Supreme Court, Colorado, by a narrow margin. You know, there were 7 democratically appointed judges, 4-3. They kept Trump off the ballot. And obviously, that was overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court. But I think there is the stomach in this polarized climate to try to make, even though it won't have much of a chance of success, to try to make a long shot effort to keep Kamala Harris off the ballot.
And to that point, you know, there certainly is a stomach at the Supreme Court. Who would have thought that they'd be divided on the question of immunity, right, a few months ago? So there is perhaps some appetite by the Supreme Court to take up this issue, should it get that far.
Oh, I agree completely. And regardless of what side you're on, there are many Republicans that think that Trump has been treated unfairly by our justice system. And I'm sure they would try and want to enact some vengeance through our legal system. Again, I don't think it's going to work, but I don't think it's going to stop folks from trying.
Nima Ramani, thank you so much for joining us on Legal Faceoff.
No, thanks for having me.
Rich Lenkoff is an attorney with Downey & Lenkoff, a firm with offices in Illinois, Indiana, and Wisconsin. Rich is consistently recognized by clients like McDonald's, Target, Macy's, Wendy's, and the Chicago Bears for his zealous advocacy and outstanding litigation results. Rich's many accolades include being named as an Illinois Super Lawyer from 2015 to present and leading lawyer from 2012 to present. These are designations given to less than 5% of Illinois attorneys. Rich is also an active member of his community, serving on the Legal Prep Charter Academy Advisory Board and the Northern Illinois University College of Law Board of Visitors. Rich is also a producer with credits including 85, The Greatest Team in Football History, starring Barack Obama, Bill Murray, and Mike Ditka. Renegades, a Caesar's Palace production starring Terrell Owens, Jose Canseco, and Jim McMahon, Rock of Ages, and Elvis Presley's Heartbreak Hotel in concert. In addition to hosting WGN's Legal Face-Off since 2014, Rich serves as a legal analyst for a variety of media outlets. Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service litigation firm practicing general liability, workers' compensation, professional malpractice, and intellectual property, among other practice areas. For more information about Rich and Downey & Lenkoff, please visit dl-firm.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off with Rich Lenkoff and Tina Martini. I'm Ryan Burrow. Discussions about the 25th Amendment have been going on since the January 6th attack at the U.S. Capitol, most surrounding former President Trump. Here to talk with us about that is Gregory McGarrion, Thomas and Carol Green Professor of Law at Washington University School of Law. He joins us on Legal Face-Off to chat about it. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Professor, we'll get to the discussion of the 25th as related to Trump in a second, because that's an interesting point. But now, of course, we're dealing with it in a different context. President Biden announced that he is not seeking re-election. He didn't give a reason for it in his televised address, nor in any of the other times he's addressed it, maybe in his written statement. So that has resulted in many Republicans calling for the invocation of the 25th Amendment, saying that if he's not well enough to run for re-election, he's not well enough to serve the remainder of his term. Tell us, first of all, as an expert on the 25th Amendment, what that section is, and specifically Section 4, And also, what are the chances of this successfully removing Biden from office before he exits in a few months?
Okay, well, I'll start with the end just to cut the suspense. And the answer to the last piece is the chances are zero under present circumstances. And I can say more about that. The 25th Amendment was added to the Constitution after the John Kennedy assassination to make sure that there was a constitutionally clear path for the vice president to take over the presidency if the president ran into problems, died in particular. Section 4 allows the vice president and the cabinet to vote to remove the president from office if they believe that he is not capable of fulfilling the duties of office, and that it includes some other procedures by which the president can challenge that. And if there's a disagreement between the cabinet and the president, then Congress has to resolve it. But the first move, and what Republicans are talking about now, would be for Vice President Harris and President Biden's cabinet to vote to remove him from office.
So, Professor, does the fact that Biden hasn't provided an explanation for the end of his campaign and just referencing the fact that he needs to pass the torch, during his Oval Office address earlier this week, does this lack of further detail, support the triggering of the 25th Amendment in your mind? Or do you think it's still is neutral on that point? Because a lot of people are pointing to the fact that he hasn't provided an explanation as a reason for triggering it.
I think we have to take a step back here and remember that the procedure set out in Section 4 of the 25th Amendment is an extraordinary procedure. The people, the Electoral College, but the people basically elected the president. And in this case, the people elected a 78-year-old guy who they had reason to know was going to be 4 years older at the end of his term. So that's all kind of baked into the small d Democratic choice that the voters made when they elected Biden to the presidency. And if the basis for removing him is concern that he is deteriorating mentally, I think you need a whole lot more evidence just as a basic starting point than the fact that he doesn't, provide a clear explanation of why he's choosing to do something that he's not obligated to do, which is run for re-election.
Professor, the 25th Amendment has been used, of course, almost never. It's been used when presidents undergo, surgery and they're under anesthesia where they're incapacitated for the time of that surgery. But it's never been invoked in this circumstance when, both parties have accused the president of being mentally incapacitated because of their speech pattern, because of their behavior, because of what some might consider to be, odd behavior. As you mentioned, or as we talked about earlier, that was, discussed during the Trump presidency when many Democrats thought that he was not mentally sound when he made, many of his statements. Was it meant, in your opinion, to be this political football that was, used in this way? I mean, and to that point, is it, how can you separate the politics from it, right? I mean, it seems inevitable that short of someone going under surgery or clearly being mentally incapacitated objectively that no one would argue, it seems that politics would weigh into the invocation of the 25th Amendment regardless, especially these days, of course.
Yeah, I think so. First of all, I think your observation.
What are your thoughts on that?
That we're in a condition of extreme partisan polarization, and a lot of things that shouldn't be political footballs can be or are being turned into political footballs. And you're certainly right, I think, in what you're saying, that the 25th Amendment is not supposed to be that. It's not supposed to be a political tool. Again, you're right. You can't separate something like this from politics. I mean, obviously, any invocation of constitutional authority to remove the president is going to be a political act of a certain kind, but it's not supposed to be a partisan act. And, that's why I think the Section 4 gives that extraordinary power to the president's own handpicked, chosen, albeit elected in the case of the vice president, Senate confirmed in the case of the cabinet officials, but gives the president's own team the prerogative to be the ones to remove him. So it's certainly not supposed to be a partisan exercise. I think the argument for invoking the 25th Amendment in this situation with Biden is very weak based on what we know. I mean, you certainly can't rule out the possibility for a man his age that there could be further deterioration mentally that would cross the line and that would cause the vice president and the cabinet to make a judgment that this guy can't do the job. But we haven't seen that. We've seen a guy, you know, tripping over his words and giving a really terrible performance in a televised debate. But again, I think the standard here has to be really high. With Trump, the situation, you know, I won't render any judgment about whether those arguments were right, but it was the arguments were somewhat different. The Democrats were definitely saying, hey, we think this guy is slipping mentally. But what they were really emphasizing was most of these arguments came into play after January 6th. He only had 14 days left in office. But the big argument was, my God, this guy is, you know, fomenting insurrection and is in that regard and based on that evidence unhinged and should be removed from office. And it's, I think, worth noting that Trump's own former chief of staff, John Kelly, came out and said the cabinet should invoke the 25th Amendment. So there was maybe somewhat more fire there than smoke. I think the circumstances with Biden are different. It's not completely random. I mean, in both instances, at least the people making the calls for invoking the 25th Amendment are giving a reason that, if the reason is right, would be valid. They're not just saying remove the guy because we don't like his policies. But then you have to look at the validity of the reason.
Professor, as we've talked about, you know, Section 4 hasn't ever really been used before. If it was invoked, what would the Supreme Court ultimately use to decide the issue absent precedent?
So, this, of course, as you're pointing out, this is all conjecture. It's hard to be definite because it's hypothetical. But Section 4 is designed in a way that should foreclose legal challenges that would be decided by the courts. So the cabinet and the vice president are the first movers under Section 4. So they deliver a message to Congress that the president is no longer capable of carrying out his duties and the vice president is taking over. Then, I alluded to this a little bit earlier, if the president is conscious and objects to what the cabinet and vice president are doing, he can tell Congress, hey, they're wrong, I'm capable of performing my job. And at that point, Section 4 says Congress has to make the determination, and only by a two-thirds vote of both houses of Congress is the president removed and the vice president taking over the duties of office. So that rather complicated and fraught procedure, among other things, I think is meant to keep the courts out of it and to really make this a decision of the elected branches.
Professor, thank you so much for joining us today on Legal Faceoff.
My pleasure. Thanks again.
Don't forget to listen, like, and subscribe to the Legal Faceoff podcast on social media and WGNradio.com. Zarna Garg is an Indian immigrant, wife, mom, lawyer, screenwriter, producer, stand-up comedian, and we get a chance to chat with her this week about the wild ride of her career from court to comedy. Perhaps they're very similar in nature.
Thanks very similar. Thank you. Thank you for having me. So excited to be here.
Zarna, as Ryan mentioned, you started your career as a lawyer, and then we know you became a stay-at-home mom after you and your husband had three children. So how did you make that big leap from having those life experiences to performing at an open mic night?
So first of all, it was very easy because I didn't think I could go back to law. At the time at which I left practicing law, all my clients were in jail. So I kind of had an idea that this is not going well and I should probably not be doing it. So I was very aware of how bad I was as a lawyer. And what happened was that I was looking to get back into the workforce and my all-American kids ganged up on me. And they said, Mom, you need to try comedy, which I honestly didn't think it was a job. I was like, that's not a job. I was looking for a job. And, you know, they were like, no, that's a job. You have to go. And because I had made them do so many things that they hated, I kind of felt like I owed it to them to do one thing that was out of my comfort zone.
Zarna, that's really funny that, you know, you let your clients' legal staff had us sort of decided for you. I like that. I've been recently, I tried stand up in the last year or so. It's always been a bucket list thing for me. And my logic was, you know, I'm a trial lawyer. I speak to 12 strangers all the time and think on my feet. I thought, how difficult could it be? And that was very dumb because it's incredibly different, incredibly difficult. But what characteristics have you taken from your legal career that you think translate to what you're doing now in comedy?
Well, writing, first of all. The love of writing and the ability to write brief and quick. You know, there's an actual writing structure to joke writing, to being a stand-up comic. And I do think that going through law school and having to finesse every thought and idea and how it's going to land is a very stand-up comedy skill. So the writing is number one. The presentation, I also worked in trial law when I was doing law. The presentation skills are definitely very similar. But it kind of ends there because in law, your job is to aggressively pursue the other side, right? Whereas in comedy, you kind of have to let it breathe. It's going to work or it's not going to work. And you have to be willing to accept that. And as a lawyer, that's a very hard thing. I have many jokes that I love that the audience has no interest in. And the lawyer in me wants to get into a fight with the audience constantly. Like, no, you're wrong. This is actually funny. But in order to be a successful comic, you have to take that step back and really analyze what it is emotionally that's not landing and work on it.
So there have been some new interviews you've done where you've talked about how the world has changed since you were practicing law. But one of the ways that it's changed for all of us, whether we practice law or not, is the fact that you've said social media is a really important part of gaining momentum with respect to your stand-up comedy. Why don't you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think there's a place in the world for somebody who wants to do something, but is adamant that they're not going to be on social media. I understand that there is a spectrum. There are people who love it. There are people who hate it. But we all need to be on it. That's my opinion in 2024. Back in the day, like not even 5 years ago, you could write a phenomenal set and do it live and build a career just doing that. Today, you can't do that because the first thing any booker at any club is going to look for before they book you is what's your social media standing. Because they need to know if you can sell tickets, if people actually know about your work. So it is a very... it's a new development, but it has benefited many of us. Like a person like me would probably have no shot at a career in comedy, except for social media. The fact that the public in the whole world likes what I do makes it easier and even in some cases possible for me to do it live at many venues. Because I remember pre-COVID, there were many, many clubs where they would just look at me and say, "You're not our demographic." Which was code for you're too old, you have an accent, you know, all these other things. And all of that went away because if millions of people in the world like my work, then somebody is going to take note of it. So social media, very important. And if you treat it with a positive aspect, like if you go into social media with a positive mindset, it can be your biggest asset in building this career.
Zarna, do you lean into your legal background as part of your act? Do you tell jokes about, you know, your legal experience? Do you use that or do you stay away from that entirely?
It happens naturally. You know, you know what they say, you can't stop the legal thinking. Like it happens naturally in life and in comedy. I don't really work at it, but it kind of just comes out. Like I could be in a club doing a set and I see like somebody knock a glass over and break it. And the PI lawyer in me is like, oh my God, stop the presses, please. Yeah, I do not need. I mean, it's your brain is just wired a certain way once you've been through the legal grind for a few years.
But do you actually reference your time as a lawyer? Do you tell any jokes about like your life as a lawyer?
But it's bombastic. I mean, I talk about how everybody's always in jail. It's not true.
Yeah.
You know, but people love hearing it. People love hating on lawyers. So that kind of works.
So you've done some pretty cool stuff since you switched careers. Why don't you tell us what it's like, for example, touring with Tina Fey and Amy Poehler and some of the other cool things you've done?
Yeah, I mean, it's all happened organically. Tina Fey and Amy Poehler, like they're, you know, icons. And I learned so much just touring with them, how they run their own business, how they connect with their fans and all of it. The best thing that I've learned is that you can take the legal skills and parlay them in many different ways. I mean, I don't know if your listeners, I'm going to say this to your listeners as a service that I do to my fan base. If you're a lawyer and you like to write and you like to do this whole legal oral presentation thing, in the comedy world, there is a lot of space for you today. Everybody needs somebody who can write something humorous. Even something as basic as writing Instagram captions is today a job. The companies hire people to do that. And you know, it's not the kids of today. People think it's the kids running social media. It's absolutely not true. If kids were running it, every Instagram caption would be a peace out sign. But it's very thoughtfully done. And there are so many legal skills that transfer over, including, like, I've learned in my social media, how I write my captions has gotten me a lot of attention. How I tweet. My tweets are funny, but any lawyer could write what I write in tweets. You know what I mean? It's written in a specific joke, like back in the law school days, IRAC, issue resolution. Like, my brain is always working in that format. So I've done cool things. I've acted in a movie that I never thought I was going to be acting in. In fact, I kind of tried to decline it several times, but then they said the words that got me on board instantly. They said, "Zarna, this is the role of a woman who is constantly disappointed in her husband and kids." And I said, "Let's go. Step aside, Meryl. Zarna is here for this role."
The magic words. Zarna, last question here on Legal Face Off. I'm sure there's a lot of people listening, particularly lawyers like me, who think they can do this, who have, like me, forever thought they were funny and, you know, funny at parties and thought they could jump into stand-up comedy. I found out the hard way that maybe I'm not as funny as I think. But what's the one piece of advice you'd give to any aspiring stand-up, be they coming from the law background or something else, who, again, who's hovering this idea, who might just want to jump in and do it? What's your one piece of advice to make that easier?
Don't worry about whether you think you're funny or not. That's not what makes us great stand-up comic. Think about what are interesting things you can say on stage that make people think. They will find the funny in you. Trying to be funny is not going to make anybody funny. But you get up there and you say things that you think are ironic, are interesting, have a little sarcasm to them, and you just let it breathe. Like, sit, put the thought out there and let it breathe with the audience for a minute. Because one of the things that that people who start out, the mistakes they make is if they don't get a laugh right away, they're like, "I thought I was funny, but I guess I'm not funny." It's not about that. Today's comic, particularly with all the diverse voices that are entering the arena, it's more about what are the interesting things you're saying in this world, and people will find the humor in it and trust that.
So, Zarna, you're going to be in Chicago. You've got a show August 10th at the Den, correct?
Yes, that's right. Yes.
And you've got a YouTube podcast. What? Tell us a little bit about that.
It's a podcast with me and my whole family. It's a first of its kind. Five guards, all of us, me, my husband, and three kids. And we, in each podcast episode, debate everyday life issues. So things that every family in the world is talking about, like, why are we spending so much money on food? Is a recent topic, for example. And we had to go through where is it all going? Like, it feels like a bottomless pit. But, you know, those types of things, what do these kids know about sex? You know, my husband and I learned the hard way on the podcast that our 11-year-old has kissed somebody. We almost fell off our chairs. We thought the shocker would come from the 18-year-old. It was the 11-year-old.
Where can people find the podcast?
On YouTube, Spotify, and Apple, and everywhere where podcasts are seen and heard. Yeah.
Zarna Garg, thank you so much for joining us. Look forward to seeing some of those videos. And
thank you.
Podcasts.
Thank you for having me. Namaste, everybody.
You are listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face Off. Dina is a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell and being selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications, including Chambers & Partners and World Trademark Review. Tina is also the recipient of the Anti-Defamation League's Women of Achievement Award and has been recognized by Crain's Chicago Business as one of Chicago's most influential minority lawyers. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is an author, columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host, and she frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current issues and trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. McDermott, Will & Emery is an integrated international law firm. McDermott has an uncompromising commitment to legal excellence, extraordinary client service, and a high-performance culture. It is committed to helping clients achieve stellar legal and business results today and well into the future. To contact Tina and to learn more about McDermott, Will & Emery, visit MWE.com.
Welcome back to Legal Faceoff on WGN. It's time for the Legal Grab Bag. Of course, we have the pleasure of being joined by Beth Crosa, Director of Operations at Peter J. Crosa & Company, and Mike Petrie, CEO and founder of Webutation. This is our first LFO since former President Donald Trump was shot and first since President Joe Biden announced he's ending his reelection bid. Rich, where do you want to take our Trump watch today?
Well, wait a second. Was he shot? Question mark. That a bullet? Question mark. There's some discussion now by FBI Director Chris Wray that it was shrapnel that hit him. So stay tuned for that. Legal face-off investigators are all over that story. We always start off our grab bag, my friends, with Trump Watch. As we were talking with the professor earlier, he's the greatest gift to legal analysis since O.J. Simpson, for sure. We just talked, actually, about what the chances of success of his litigation, Tina, trying to stop Kamala Harris from being the Democrat nominee. I think we all agree that that's probably a long shot, but as we then discussed with our other expert, you know, who knows? These days, Supreme Court has overturned precedent dealing with abortion. They've taken up the presidential immunity issue. So this might end up in the Supreme Court. Any chance that any legal challenges to Kamala are successful? What do you think, Tina?
Yes, Rich, based on our conversation earlier in the show, is that it's pretty unlikely. I mean, the whole 25th Amendment, it sounds like it was designed to avoid the interference or impact of courts, as you profile, that has not stopped the Supreme Court from making decisions in certain cases, disregarding precedent, et cetera. I think that this is just part of the plan to make her integration into the campaign and into the race difficult. It's probably going to be one of any number of things that is done, you know, between now and November. But I think it's pretty unlikely that the Supreme Court is going to get involved here. That's just my personal opinion.
Yeah, I mean, Mike, Beth, regardless of whether any challenges to Kamala Harris are successful, a couple of weeks ago, there was an interesting article in New York Times detailing the literally years of preparation that Republican lawyers have been engaged in to contest the election. Now, that was when Biden was running. I don't think it's going to change with Kamala. So inevitably, I think there's going to be lots of litigation, both leading up to the November election now with this Kamala issue. And after it, if Trump loses, he's going to be questioning the veracity of the results and the fairness of the election. So this is not an issue that will end after the election, I believe. What are your thoughts?
Follow the money. Scrutinize those financial records. Examine those disbursements. Interview that campaign staff. Listen, whistleblowers is a hot topic today. You get one whistleblower, maybe someone will come up forth and give up some of that intelligence that's necessary to maybe fight this or prove there's been some discrepancies with the money.
Yeah. Beth, any thoughts on whether Kamala will not be able to run in Biden instead because of the specter of litigation?
So if you're talking about the FEC complaint about the campaign money that the Biden-Harris reelection campaign raised. My thoughts is, are you getting at that?
Yeah, that's one of the allegations for sure.
Her name was on the account. My understanding, she was a signer on the account, is still able to access that money. Also, Biden was not officially the candidate until August. So you have those things that the FEC, I guess, usually takes quite a long time before when they do their investigation. And so I don't think that would be completed before the November election. So I'm not sure about the money. I'm not sure about the other legal challenges. If something came up between yesterday and today,
The DNC will kick off here in Chicago later August, I suppose. Well, one of my favorite bands and one of my favorite songs is in the legal spotlight this week is the Beastie Boys sue for copyright infringement over an ad. RIP MCA, by the way. What you want to say about this story, Tina?
Earlier this month, the Beastie Boys filed a lawsuit in New York federal court against the parent company of Chili's, the grill and bar, for copyright infringement as well as trademark infringement. The whole basis for this is a commercial that Chili's apparently shared over social media that used or riffed on significant portions of the Beastie Boys' Sabotage music video from about 30 years ago without their permission. So the complaint claims that Chili's video shows three characters wearing 70s-style wigs, fake mustaches, and sunglasses, which were definitely intended to evoke, especially among Beastie Boys fans, the video and the three members of the Beastie Boys that were in character performing various scenes during that music video. In the Chili's ad, these characters perform scenes depicting them robbing ingredients from a Chili's restaurant. The ad has fictitious opening credits, just like the video did. And the Beastie Boys claim that there's sound recording, music compositions, and videos that are all lifted without their permission. As many fans know, the Beastie Boys are actually pretty famous for not licensing their songs for product advertising purposes. So that really exacerbates the situation here. And deceased member Adam Yauch actually included a provision in his will prohibiting these types of uses. So, you know, the Beastie Boys are asking for Chili's to remove the ad from everywhere they've posted it. They're seeking $150,000 in damages. This is not the first time that they have sued over copyright infringement. So my guess is that there's probably going to be a settlement out of court on this one, Rich, because while some claim that maybe it's a parody, after having dealt with a lot of parody cases in my career, that can be a pretty tricky terrain to navigate. And I'm not necessarily convinced this is a parody here because I'm not really sure there's a commentary being made here, and it's definitely a commercial purpose here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, a couple things. Number one, and Petrie will back me up on this. This is my second favorite Chili's song. You know my favorite one, Petrie.
Brass
Come on,
Monkey,
sing it.
Of course.
No, my favorite Chili's song, not Beastie Boys. You know my favorite one. I got my baby back. Say, baby, I want my baby back. You know that, of course. But you know, we cover these stories all the time, and I wonder. I mean, there's got to be a memo somewhere, Tina, at Brinker, which owns Chili's, estimating the value of the temporary use of this song before they have to stop in increased notoriety and visibility to the brand versus the amount that they will have to pay to settlement, right? Because at some point, there's no way they're not considering that. There's no way they're not considering that a song as prominent as this one. I mean, you can't go to any karaoke bar in the world and not hear Fight For Your Right. That a song as prominent as that wouldn't generate some litigation. By the way, Beastie Boys have been very litigious in the past about protecting their songs. So my take is, at some point, someone looked at the numbers and said, we will be sued, but the fact that podcasts with multi-million audiences like we do will be discussing it, therefore it has some at least temporary brand value of increasing awareness. So that's just a math equation. That's just me. Mike, Beth, what are your thoughts on this?
I actually have a question about this. I saw the video, and is there another restaurant called Chain? Because the three chefs in the commercial are using a Chili's restaurant, but they have the name Chain on there. So I was kind of looking into that. I'm not sure if Brinker International owns that particular chain, that restaurant called Chain, unless that's part of the parody. But it was a little confusing. In terms of the song, it's exactly this. It's 26 seconds, I believe, of sabotage. There's nothing changed in that. And the characters are very similar to the original music video. So I think they have a case, but I just don't know. It's confusing as to whether or not they've got the right party. Is that a Chili's commercial? I know that Chili's probably shared it because it was at a Chili's restaurant. Does anybody know?
I think the chain is probably a parody on a chain. That was my take on it. But yeah, so I mean, it's a good question. The more questions like that you have, right, the more difficult it is to prove confusion. So,
hey, can I add into the fair use analysis?
Yes, of course.
So, I mean, let's think about this purpose and character of the use, right? We got to determine whether this ad is transformative and did it add new meaning or expression to the original work, nature of the copywritten work, amount and substantiality of the portion used, and of course, market effect, right? And analyzing whether the ad has some harmed the potential market for the original work. And there's a word here that I came across, de minimis. Somebody also mentioned, I think it was Tina, as parody, but a potential defense would be assessing the potential defense raised by Chili's, such as parody, Tina mentioned this, or de minimis use. What do you think about that?
I think that someone woke up this morning and put on their IP expert hat. Mike Petrie coming in hot. With a
like
fair Chili's. Use analysis. Look at
I
that.
Like Chili's. Yeah, watch out.
I don't think it's a de minimis use here at all. I mean, it's a pretty significant taking, if you will,
yeah,
of the
Petrie.
Original work.
Yeah. Thank you, Tina. Just playing both sides here.
But admittedly, from a guy who runs Webutation, it's a pretty good analysis. Let's give him,
yes.
Let's give him that.
I'm impressed but that you know the prongs of fair use. You get the platinum star today. That's awesome.
You get a pink star.
The Beastie Boys, by the way, known for sampling hundreds of pieces of audio. So why don't they just take the I got my baby back ribs and put it in a new song? So it's problem solved. There you go.
By the way, best use of that song ever, of course, is by Fat Bastard in Austin Powers 2, The Spy Who Shagged Me.
I just have to say, I think sampling a small portion of a song is a little bit different than what we see in this commercial.
Fair. That's
well
absolutely
stated.
Fair.
All right.
Well, the defense team of the man accused of killing four students at the University of Idaho wants a change in venue. Rich, what's the latest in this case?
Yeah, Brian Koberger filed a motion to move the case from Moscow, Idaho, where the crime took place, which is a population of 41,000. He wants to move it 296 miles south to Boise, which has a population of 236,000, arguing that, you know, Moscow is a tight, small community, tightly knit. Many people know each other. It's a university town. Of course, these were university students who were murdered. And as such, and also many are connected to law enforcement in that jury pool. And as such, he argues he cannot get a fair trial, by a jury in that community. You know, you see these motions frequently. Tina, the standard is not something that is clear. It's basically up to the judge to decide whether he can avail himself of his constitutional rights in this community. And it's basically up to the judge. You know, it's not open and shut that because it's a small community or because it's a very widely reported case that everyone has heard of, it's not clear that that alone is the criteria. These days, it's not like you're going to find a juror who hasn't heard of this murder, be it in Moscow, in Boise, or in Moscow, Russia, for that case. I mean, with the news cycle being what it is, everyone knows about this case. So the idea that, well, we got to find 12 people who are oblivious to this murder is not going to happen. The question is whether you can find 12 people who are going to put any preconceived notions of right or wrong, guilty or innocent aside and judge the case based on its evidence. But anyway, Tina, I don't think that the standard that existed many years ago is still the case, given how, you know, everyone knows every story. So I think that the chance of this being moved are minimal.
I agree with you, Rich. I think it's just an evolution of the world, right? I mean, there's a connectivity and an awareness that we have of things going on way outside of our immediate geography that I think, I don't think there's going to be a material difference in terms of finding people who may have less awareness outside of, outside of the immediate vicinity of where this crime took place and where this trial is set to take place. So, I think the normal voir dire process would help figure out who the right people are to have on this jury. But I think, like you, it's unlikely it's going to get moved.
Yeah, Mike, this hearing is scheduled for August. And one of the key portions of the motion is that the local coverage is far more inflammatory than national coverage. Again, that implies that people are getting their news the way they did 30 or 40 years ago, which is by turning on the TV and watching your local coverage. Now, perhaps there's some data supporting that people in this small, relatively, you know, rural community are getting their news. But again, it's a college town. People are getting their news the same way people all over the world get their news in clips from the media, from internet. So I think that's, that argument's going to fail as well.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, unless you're living under a rock, I mean, there's no way that you haven't heard about this particular case. I mean, you can go from public opinion surveys to jury questionnaires, like as we just talked about during voir dire, but there also could be focus groups or social media analysis as far as online sentiment, and maybe the potential of identifying potential jurors who may have expressed strong opinions online. So it's going to be tough. I agree.
Beth, agree?
Disagree? I do not agree. You know, being in a small town like this, not only might they be related to these folks, they could know these folks, they could have gone to the university. I do believe that it should be moved to Boise. I believe it would help with any potential, you know, chance for an appeal. If you went ahead and moved the trial to Boise, I believe there's precedent for that. I'm not an attorney. I know that I feel for the victims, and I know that they wanted it to be local, but I just think there's a strong argument that the defense could come back later and try for an appeal.
But don't you think, I mean, to your point, if you know the victims here, you want justice, right? And that's mm-hmm. in your community. By moving the trial, one of the other things you're doing is stripping victims, like community members, of the right to decide the fate of something that happened in their jurisdiction. So that's one of the problems with moving it is, for sure, there might be people who know the victims. If I was one of those people, I would want, not because of vengeance, I would want to hear the case on its evidence, but I would want to think that, well, it happened here. We deserve to be part of the trial. So that's, I think, one argument against moving it, but it's a good point for sure.
Tina, you're on the music scene again today. You've got another copyright infringement story for us, this one involving the NBA.
So we've got a lot of IP infringements going on this week, Ryan, on the grab bag. So this time it involves more than a dozen NBA teams who are all facing copyright lawsuits from various music companies over allegations that these teams used songs, again, like the last case we talked about, in social media videos without permission. So 14 separate actions were filed in federal court last week, accusing each club of using copyrighted music in these videos on various social media platforms without permission in an effort to increase viewership and engage fan bases. Generally speaking, as we've talked about on Legal Face-Off before, social media platforms have libraries of licensed music for users to add to their videos, but they can't be used for commercial or promotional videos posted by brands, and that requires a separate license. It's called a sync license, just like a conventional ad on TV. So what's interesting is that these cases seem to be geographically based. So, for example, the case against the New York Knicks involves alleged infringements of songs by musicians who are considered New York legends, Jay-Z and Cardi B. Similarly, the case against the Philadelphia 76ers references songs by Meek Mill, who is a Philadelphia native. There are a bunch of other clubs other than the Knicks and 76ers, including the Cavs, the Nuggets, the Pacers, the Miami Heat, and a number of others. And in each case, the allegations are essentially the same, that the defendants should have known better, that they are all very aggressive in enforcing their intellectual property rights, including copyright, and they leverage these IP laws to aggressively protect their own IPs, so they should know better, and yet they were willfully infringing the intellectual property rights of the various named plaintiffs. So, Rich, I mean, this is another one, whereas you said earlier, you know, folks know better, so they're probably doing that cost-benefit calculus.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the shoe's on the other foot here a little bit. You're taking on, you know, one of the most powerful brands in the world. Doesn't detract from the fact that they, you know, presumably these defendants should know better and have calculated, like we talked about, these costs into the equation. But listen, that's the world we're living in. On the one hand, Tina, as you know, having, you know, being one of the preeminent lawyers in this field in the world, like the IP is more valuable than ever in the quest for content. Protecting IP is more important than ever, and people are more litigious than ever. On the other hand, people seem to be taking more chances than ever. It's incongruous. It doesn't make sense because, you know, we cover these lawsuits, but people are taking more chances than ever. So I don't know. How do you account for that dichotomy? Thank God that's happening for people like you to keep you busy. But it just shocks me that people are still, you know, using really obvious IP without permission, unless they're just doing it for, like we talked about, to get some brief, you know, benefit from it. Who knows?
I mean, I think there's a certain element of that. I'm not really sure exactly what's going on here. I do think that there is a certain bucket of folks, like whoever's making the decision, especially when it comes to things like social media posts, where those sometimes are ephemeral, the thinking that you're less likely to get caught. But then when you look at the number of followers on some of these social media platforms of the parties that we're talking about, there is such a huge following. And there are people at these different companies, especially those that own a ton of IP, that have folks internally that they hire where their sole purpose and their job is to be scoping out social media platforms for infringements like this. So sometimes it's inadvertent, but sometimes it's intentional with the type of calculus that we've been talking about, that they think the bang they're going to get from whatever it is they're doing is going to far outweigh whatever type of economic result they can achieve through a settlement, most likely.
All right. Well, this next story in the grab bag has got a Netflix series written all over it. Tina, here's your log line. A neo-Nazi leader is indicted for a plot to have a Santa Claus poison children in New York.
Yeah, Ryan. So this one is really disturbing, like a lot of these stories that we cover when we're talking about these types of organizations. So there was a 21-year-old Georgian, as in from the country, Georgia, national, named Mikhail. I'm not going to pronounce his name right, Chikvishvili, who is the alleged leader of the neo-Nazi organization Manic Murder Cult, also known as MKY for short. And he's been indicted on charges that he was planning a mass attack targeted against racial minorities and Jewish children in New York City. The plan was for a person dressed as Santa Claus to distribute poisoned candy to this targeted community. He was arrested in Moldova earlier this month and just indicted by a federal grand jury in Brooklyn. He faces 4 counts of soliciting hate crimes and acts of mass violence. This organization is based in Russia and the Ukraine and apparently promotes acts of violence and mass murder against racial minorities, the Jewish community, and other groups that this organization deems as undesirables. The defendant was allegedly recruiting others to commit violent acts and killings to further the organization's objectives with an end goal of spreading hatred, fear, and destruction. Prosecutors allege that starting back in 2021, he was distributing a manifesto that he authored called The Hater's Handbook, which described ways for the organization's members to further the mission by describing in detail how to commit acts of mass violence, such as school shootings and attacks on large outdoor festivals, conventions, celebrations, and parades. Apparently, back in September of last year, he was trying to recruit an undercover FBI agent, who obviously he didn't know was undercover, to try to get this person to actually commit violent hate crimes and asked him to provide video proof. The defendant tried to recruit this undercover agent to be the Santa Claus for this scheme and provided instructions on how to extract ricin poison, actually, from castor beans, put it into the candy, instructed him how to distribute the candy And then instructed him to take a taxi to an unspecified location to burn the Santa costume and to leave whatever was left in stockings in random nearby apartments. If the defendant is convicted, he faces a total of 50 years in prison across all four counts, including a maximum of 20 years for soliciting violent felonies and 20 years for distributing information regarding how to make and use explosive devices. In my mind, Rich, if this person gets convicted, he should be put away for the rest of his life.
Yeah, can't disagree with that. You know, I've always thought Santa was terrifying, to be honest. Maybe that's just because I'm a Jewish individual, but I've always thought there was always some creepiness about Santa. This supports that, Beth. Don't take candy from strangers and now include Santa in that group. Beth, what are your thoughts? Do you agree?
I mean, just absolutely horrible. I'm so sad at the human race and another example of things not really evolving too much.
But we did manage to Ryan's point, work in Nazis and Santa in one nice story. So perhaps there's not all lost.
I'm telling you, five part series. It'll top Netflix in 2 weeks.
Nazi Santa.
You got it. You got it. All right, let's move along. You've heard of sports beef and rapper beef. There's apparently such a thing as lawyer beef, isn't there, Rich?
Now, this one's bananas. It's a little long. I'll kind of give you the highlights, but this is in Phoenix. A couple of billboard attorneys, prominent PI lawyers, have gotten into a feud, not just your regular garden variety feud, Tina, but one that resulted in a lawsuit. You know, lawyers frequently fight. We often cover those stories, but this resulted in a lawsuit. It resulted in a podcast dedicated to this feud, 2 episodes entitled Negretti versus Rafi. Those are the two lawyers who are feuding here. This is again in Phoenix, where they openly talk about their hatred for each other. And the one attorney gave a long interview explaining all his issues with the other attorney. Again, it digressed to the point where allegedly one attorney called a bomb threat. February 9th of this year, a bomb threat was made at the offices of Rafi Law, and the police actually responded, poured into the building, and then someone was outside taking photos, posted those photos to an account that was shared by 62,000 lawyers, adding, of course, to the allegation that this was the other law firm that called this in. So, I don't know, Tina. I mean, we always talk about lack of civility in the legal field, but this is this is taking it to the next level.
Rich, I mean, there were very interesting aspects to this story. And, you know, one of them was, you know, accusing the other of stealing clients and things like that. I mean, at the end of the day, it's a client's decision as to who they want to work with in terms of a lawyer. Obviously, we're bound by ethical responsibilities. So to the extent that either one of them acted unethically, then, you know, they're going to have their state bar to deal with. But, you know, I just wish that people could get along. I mean, put aside some of that, you know, like those extreme examples of acting unethically or doing things that are illegal. You know, it just makes me wish that people can get along better.
A callback, as it were, to our earlier reference to Rodney King. Mike, you work with lawyers all the time. You've seen, I'm sure, some interesting behavior from lawyers, but anything like this?
I mean, never have I ever, like the game, never have I ever heard of swatting between two professional individuals, such as attorneys and lawyers, right? Typically, that's between two gamers on Call of Duty because one didn't like one the other. So they'll swat each other. That's a serious and dangerous tactic because there have been swatting scenarios where people actually have been killed by the SWAT team for these bomb threats at their homes. So, I mean, clearly there are some, you know, underlying issues, like maybe they played ping pong so much that the other didn't let the other guy win. You know what I mean, Rich? All right, that's a different story. But whatever the case might be, there's going to be a lot to sift through this animosity during their legal battle.
Mike's referencing a game of ping pong, well, several games where Mike came out the victor. I will say that perhaps our abilities or one of our abilities was influenced by a couple of cocktails that we had. But I want a rematch. I'll just leave it at that.
Let it
Mike's
go,
a good
Rich.
Ping pong player. We'll let it go.
Just Let it go. All right. It'll be fine. You'll be fine. All right. Well, I haven't watched this Apple TV's Presumed Innocent. Sounds like there was a wild twist at the end. Rich, can you walk us through without maybe spoiling the show for us?
Well, we will not spoil for sure, but we like to cover on this show legal content. And this was one of the more interesting legal stories recently, got a lot of attention. I think they said it was Apple's most streamed or most viewed show in history, which is interesting. Of course, based on the Scott Turow novel, who is himself a lawyer, Tina, and the 1990 film of the same name starring Harrison Ford that had a great twist ending before the day, that was in the day when you could actually have a twist ending, when you would have to go to the theater, watch it, and then not speak to anyone for another 6 months, right? Everyone remembers The Sixth Sense, The Crying Game. Those were the days when you could actually have spoilers. These days, it's very hard. But much like its predecessor, this TV version has a twist ending. Many are criticizing it as far-fetched and not very strong. But I liked it. I watched it. I thought the I wanted more. Usually, Tina, you watch these shows, and there's too much courtroom drama. This one, actually, I wanted more. The protagonist is Jake Gyllenhaal, and the villain, so to speak, the person prosecuting him, is his brother-in-law, Peter Skarsgård, and their scenes were very dynamic, very good. I wanted more of that, but a pretty good legal thriller. Tina, have you seen it yet? Are you going to watch it?
I haven't seen it yet. I'm definitely going to watch it. I've heard it's terrific. I remember seeing the original movie many years ago. I remember reading the book. I think Scott Turow, at least last I checked, is a neighbor of mine. I think he's from Evanston. So, I remember the original movie was terrific. It's been a long time since I've seen it, but I remember it was pretty awesome.
All right. Beth, Mike, have you seen the show? And we'll end off our podcast, as we always do, and learning a little bit more about our guests. We'll ask you, after you've got any thoughts on Presumed Innocent, your favorites, it can't be Presumed Innocent, but your favorite all-time legal movie or TV show. I guess we'll include TV show too. So any thoughts on this one first? And then second, what's your favorite all-time legal TV show or movie besides Presumed Innocent?
Well, with this one, I have a question. Does the show's ending offer a more, say, satisfying or thought-provoking conclusion than the book? I do some micro reading and some micro watching. So I have not had the ability to do both on this particular book and show. So that's one question. And then how's it changed the culprit? Who is this? Rusty?
We can't give it away. We cannot spoil it. But the ending is highly controversial. I usually take a deep dive into the stuff and listen to podcasts and reading. And most people do not like the ending. But it is a twist. I will give it to them that I did not see the culprit coming, and I sort of went through all the possible suspects. So it's pretty good in that regard, but.
Okay.
Beth, have you seen it?
Yes, I've seen it. Oh, but go ahead.
I was going to round it off with just that last question. As far as favorite lawyer movie, I have to go with The Firm. That Tom Cruise fella.
Absolutely. A movie well known because Wilford Brimley was, seen to be very intimidating as a 90-year-old guy chasing Tom Cruise, among other great parts of The Firm. A good one. Beth, favorite all-time legal TV show or film?
Yeah, so Tom Cruise, You Can't Handle the Truth. What's that movie?
A Few Good Men.
Yes, A Few Good Men. That's my fave. My Cousin Vinny, I like also. And then, did you want me to talk about the show?
Sure, go ahead. Don't give it away.
I won't give it away. Very big fan of the original with Harrison Ford. Very good chemistry between Ford and the female in that movie. I wasn't as crazy about the female pick in this movie, but I still felt that it was a great kind of rewriting and adding on to the original. Way more development of the characters of the lawyers in the movie. Just really three-dimensional, very well worth watching.
Okay, you heard it there. Strong recommendation. Ryan Burrow, favorite legal movie or TV show? Go.
Let's go with the 1997 Jim Carrey comedy, Liar, Liar.
Liar.
The pen is blue.
Good one. Very good. Let's go with Lisa. Lisa, you got a favorite for us before we turn to Tina?
I like The Lincoln Lawyer.
TV show or movie? Which one?
TV show.
I like both of them, but I like the movie better.
All right. Good one, Tina. I have a feeling you're going to go with a TV show, and I think I know which one.
Yeah. Rich, you know me so well. So I think I mentioned in one of our recent shows that I just watched L.A. Law straight through from beginning to end, all, I think, 8 seasons, if I remember correctly. And it is fantastic. I mean, put aside the fact that people wore a lot of makeup, they had a lot of hairspray, a lot of shoulder pads, a lot of strange colors and cuts on those suits. But I mean, it was the beginning of David E. Kelly's career. And one of the things that he's known for, one of the many things, is sort of the courtroom action. And the writing on that show obviously was a Stephen Bochco series. So everything that Stephen Bochco was known for comes through in that series. But, you know, it made many stars' careers. There were a few that really started their career on that show. So the acting was terrific, but the writing was awesome. And so I loved Ally McBeal, too, but I have to go with L.A. Law.
David Kelly, former lawyer, who went on, of course, to produce Presumed Innocent, which we're talking about now, and L.A. Law, one of the great theme songs of all time, right? Dun, dun,
dun, dun, dun, dun, dun, dun, dun.
Back in the day when shows actually had theme songs with credits that were long, you know, L.A. Law was great. Great trunk slam to start every show.
I love the license plate.
License plate was great. Tina had one, a version of it, of course. You know, I got so many. I love Pacino. So there's a lot of Pacino choices. I love The Devil's Advocate, you know, which is just one of the best screamy Pacino performances of all time. You can separate Pacino in decibels, right, in his career. And when he plays the devil in The Devil's Advocate, that's one of the greatest screaming performances of all. He's an absentee landlord. That's great. And then I love Injustice for All, right? One of the original courtroom dramas starring Pacino, of course, with a famous rant of, you're out of order. The whole damn system's out of order. That one. So some great Pacino ones, but those are all good ones for sure.
If we wrap this up, Lisa want to chime in?
Lisa gave us one.
Oh, did we get her? All right, Lisa.
Yeah, Lincoln Lawyer.
There we go. All right. All right. We'll wrap this up. All right. Thank you so much, Mike Petrie and Beth Crosa. And that'll do it for the latest installment of Legal Face Off on WGN. Special thanks to Gregory McGarrian with Thomas and Carol Green, professor of law at Washington University School of Law in St. Louis, comedian Zarna Garg, and Nima Ramani, the president and co-founder of West Coast Trial Lawyers. Also, shouts out to Ben Anderson and Lisa Stegel for Tina Martini, Rich Lenkoff. I'm Ryan Burrow. Thanks again for joining us on Legal Face Off on WGN.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Lenkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question? Just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget.